We usually like to do a little review. As we began yesterday, we said that we were going to do three things through with the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous. Number one, we were going to find out what was the problem. Number two, we were going to find out what was the solution. And number three, we were going to lay out a plan of recovery. We began the doctor's opinion and Bill's story in this section of the book. We found out the exact nature of the problem. We found out that the problem was in the body and the mind, a physical allergy and a mental obsession. We found out that the physical allergy was manifested by the craving of alcohol. And we summarized this by saying that if we had an allergy to alcohol, we could not drink safely. Then we went into the main problem. We said the center's in the mind. And we talk about the obsession, which makes us take the first drink, and the first drink sets off the allergy. These two things together made us powerless over alcohol. Then we went in the second section of the book, chapters 2, 3, and 4, and it was in these chapters that we learned the solution. We talked about the solution was a power greater than ourselves, and they said that we could initiate and find this power. How to do it was simply by believing, and that this was the beginning. Then we went through chapter 3 and learned more about alcoholism, about the subtle insanity which precedes the first drink. And then in this beautiful chapter of We Agnostics, we were able to evaluate our conception of God and why probably it wasn't working. All of these things is done and all the groundwork has been laid, and we have the information for the first two steps. And this puts us in a position to go into the third and final and main purpose of the program, how it works, or how do you recover from alcoholism. And this is a precise plan of recovery. And this brings us to chapter 5, which is how it works.
Good morning. My name is Charlie Parmian. I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic.
Hi, Charlie.
Because I'm a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and with the grace of the power that I found through the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found necessary to take a drink for 5,672 days today, one day at a time, and for this I'm very grateful. What we're getting ready to go into right now is how it works, the actual plan program of action necessary to bring about that solution that we've been looking at. The plan program of action necessary to bring about the personality change sufficient to recover from the disease of alcoholism. And as John told us yesterday when we talked about the history, or when he did, talked about the fact that when Bill was ready to write Chapter 5, this program of action, that Bill felt very inadequate. He didn't really know for sure what he wanted to do. Didn't really know what he wanted to say. We must remember, up until that period of time, they had been using these concepts from the Oxford groups, and they really were not numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You go back and look at those ideas and you can break them out to 6 things, but they really were not a numbered thing either. Bill could see that there was a lot of loopholes in there for the keen intellectual alcoholic mind to slip through. And he knew they needed to be broadened out. He knew also that it needed to be made into a single-purpose thing rather than a multi-purpose thing, dealing primarily with alcoholism only. And since he felt so inadequate to do that, we do know that while he was in bed and leaning against the headboard, pillow behind his back, pad and pencil trying to start, that he decided he needed to pray and he needed to meditate. And he laid the pad and pencil down, and he prayed, and he meditated for a while. And in a little bit, he picked it up, and he began to write, and in maybe 30 minutes or less, he wrote what we know today as how it works, which is the planned program of action. We also know that what he wrote originally was a little bit different than what you have in your book today. And what we're going to read this morning is the original manuscript on how it works, and the wording that he used with God's guidance before it was passed around to the rest of the members at that time. When they got a hold of it, they made some changes in it. So as we read through this, we will try by the tone of my voice to point out the differences between his original, how it works, and what was actually printed in the big book when it appeared in 1939. I think it's very, very interesting. It's very enlightening. I think we might see there was one or two things lost in the changing from what he originally wrote and what finally appeared in the big book. So if you're ready, let's go to how it works, and we'll open up and we'll start right there. Anything else?
Yeah.
He can't hear us.
Your mic's off.
My mic's off. Now is it on?
Yeah.
Well, no wonder you couldn't hear me. So, in the reading of how it works, and I'll repeat just a little bit for just a moment, what I'm going to read is what Bill originally wrote after guidance and put it in the original manuscript and then passed around to the rest of the people, and they in turn made some changes in it. There will be a little bit of difference in what I'm going to read and what your big book says now, and I'll try by the tone of my voice to point out the differences as we go through how it works. So if you're all ready, we'll go to chapter 5. We'll start with how it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our directions. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a way of life which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to follow directions. At some of these, you may balk. You may think you can find an easier, softer way. We doubt if you can. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that you are dealing with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for you, but there is one who has all power. That one is God. You must find him now. Half measures will avail you nothing. You stand at the turning point. Throw yourself under his protection and care with complete abandon. Now we think you can take it. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as your program of recovery. Number one, admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Number two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Number three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care and direction of God as we understood him. Number four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Number five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Number six, were entirely willing that God remove all these defects of character. Number seven, humbly on our knees, ask him to remove our shortcomings, holding nothing back. Number eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make complete amends to them all. Number nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Number ten, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Number 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our contact with God, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Number 12, having had a spiritual experience, as the result of this course of action, we tried to carry this message to others, especially alcoholics, and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Now you may exclaim, what an order, I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic...
This is the doctor's opinion.
The chapter to the agnostic...
Chapter 4.
And our personal adventures before and after...
More about alcoholism...
...have been designed to sell you three pertinent ideas. A, that you are alcoholic and cannot manage your own life.
Step 1.
B, that probably no human power can relieve your alcoholism.
Step 2.
C, that God can and will.
Still step 2.
If you're not convinced on these vital issues, you ought to reread the book to this point or else throw it away.
Now we can see how Bill, what was going on tonight. This was the night he wrote, penned the 12 steps. And we can see that, you know, they were revealed to him at this section of the book. And if we will actually, it's a strange place for the 12 steps to be, really. You can see the 12 steps in the final third, it's in the main purpose, but in the last section of the book, in the recovery section, was when he wrote the steps. You know, in most cases, he didn't plan this, he was guided by God, but, you know, you could see if you were going to usually write a book on 12 steps, you would have the 12 steps in the front and then write. But he didn't have the 12 steps until he got to the last section of the book. So he put them in here, and then he goes back in this review, and he says, our description of the alcoholic. Now, he says, after he got them wrote, he said, in the doctor's opinion, you can, you know, if you have read these earlier chapters, you should have the ABCs. Now, he says, a doctor's opinion, the chapter of the agnostic, chapter 4, is our adventure before and after, Bill's story, and more about alcoholism. These earlier chapters, which we have went over yesterday, were designed to sell you three pertinent ideas. And these three pertinent ideas relate to the first two steps. Now, he says, if you have read the first part of this book, you should have the first two steps. And he said, and if you don't, you ought to reread them and get them, or else throw the book away. Because there's no, and then if you have them, he said, if you are convinced, then you are now at step 3. You know, there's no way that you can go to step 3 if you don't have 1 and 2. Because step 3 says we make a decision, and the decision means to cut two facts in two. And so you at least got to have two facts before you can go into the decision of step 3. And this book gives us those facts. Now, if you, you know, we say the first two steps are only conclusions in the mind. They are not steps that you work. You know, it's not part of the recovery process. The first two steps lay the foundation for our recovery. All the recovery begins in step 3. You know, it's like when you go to the doctor and the doctor diagnoses you and he finds your problem. Well, there's not any improvement in finding the problem. You know, I know when I go to the doctor sometimes and he finally says, well, you know, Joe, I believe you got the flu. Well, that's nice to know, but I'm still sick. You know, I don't feel no better. And then he prescribes for you. The doctor writes you a prescription. You're standing there now, you know what's wrong with you, and you got your answer in your hand. But you will not have any improvement until you carry out the treatment program. Clerk, go home and take the medicine and do what they carry out the plan of action. All recovery comes through this. But these first two things are very, very important. They are the foundation for our recovery because they put us in a position now. He said, if you are convinced, then you now at step 3. And this leads us into the plan program of action, which is the 10 recovery steps in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous.
I used to read how it works, and then it would say, being convinced we were at step three, and I'd say, well, where in the hell did one and two go? There's no instructions anywhere in the big book on how to work steps one and two. We're going to find from step three on, each time, it tells us why we need to work it, how to work it, and what the results will be. But that information is not there for steps one and two because you really don't work steps one and two. They're conclusions drawn in the mind based upon ideas presented to us in the doctor's opinion in the first four chapters. And if we're convinced on those three vital issues, then we have already completed one and two. We have admitted we're powerless over alcohol and our life has become unmanageable. And we've come to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. And if we're convinced on those things, then we're ready to go on with step three. I think the other thing that's apparent in the reading of the original manuscript is Bill did not intend for the 12 steps to be a set of suggestions. He intended for them to be a set of directions on how to recover from the disease of alcoholism. In fact, in the original How It Works, he mentioned the directions three times, that we were ready to follow directions. And he mentioned in step three that we made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care and direction of God as we understood it. And we know that the original members had kept the right to look at what Bill wrote and to change what they felt needed to be changed. And after he wrote How It Works and passed it around to the other members, that's when the crap hit the fan. You know, that's when this one group of individuals said, what do you mean trying to tell alcoholics what they have to do? You can't give directions to people like us. Alcoholics just won't do anything if you try to direct them. And I'm almost sure another faction said, Bill, you didn't tell them hard enough. You need to tighten the crank and make it stronger. And then we had this fellow named Jim, the atheist.
Go ahead, Chuck.
We had this fellow named Jim, the atheist, and if you haven't looked at his picture yet, you really should. It's hanging back by the coffee pot. If there's ever a cold-eyed sucker, that's Jim. You know? He looks like an atheist ought to look. And he said, get everything about God out of this mess. And there had to be a preacher in there, surely, that said, oh, you're not talking enough about God. And the fight went on and on and on. And finally, they begin to realize they were going to have to make some kind of compromise or they never would get this thing completed. And at the suggestion of a non-alcoholic psychiatrist, they made a few changes in How It Works. This psychiatrist said, why don't you change it from directions to suggestions? He said, probably more people would accept your book and this set of instructions if you did call them suggestions rather than directions. And he said, in your book where you keep saying, you must do this, you, he said, won't you just tell them what we had to do and say, we had to do this rather than you had to do this. And he said, where it says, you must, change it to ought. And he said, I believe if you would do that, more people would find your book more acceptable and they would use it to a greater degree. And the compromise was finally struck. And those decisions were made. Now, who knows? You know, if they had left it like the original, maybe today, instead of 1.5 million people worldwide, we might have 10 million. If they had left it as it was, instead of 1.5 million today, we might have 10,000, too. Who knows? Nobody will ever be smart enough to know. We simply know this was the history behind the book, and Bill did have to compromise here, even though he did not want to compromise. The original was, we think, with God's guidance, and then the changes were made by human beings. Joe?
Okay, he said, being convinced we were at step three. And this brings us into now a precise, specific plan of recovery that's mentioned early in the book, clear cut. Each step will be laid out in great detail. He will tell us why we need to take the step to begin with. And he uses a formula, and he gives us how does a problem exist at this point before the step. And then he tells us how to take the step. And then at the end, usually we'll find some results of having what we should have obtained from each particular step as we go through. And it begins with step three, which is we decided to turn our will and our lives over to God as we understood Him. Just what do we mean by that, and just what do we do? And it begins to describe the total problem that exists at this point. The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, we're always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the show, is forever trying to raise the lights, to violate the scene and the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as he wished, he would be great. Everyone, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, our actor may be sometime be quite virtuous. He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest or self-sacrificing. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. But with all, as with most humans, he is most likely to have varied traits. Now he begins to describe the alcoholic, and he uses all the words, you know, we talked about self-propulsion, self-will, self-centered, egocentric. And here he describes the problem as we face the total problem of alcoholism. We like to, I think it's very, very important here in step three that, and we've been usually trying to get an in-depth picture of what are we talking about, self-will. And, you know, self-will, what is this thing called self-will in human life? And he says most people try to live by this. As we go on page, in your diagram, you will have a diagram of this. And as we talk about self, we say self is the root of our problems. We're going to attempt to do a little in-depth to find out what is self. You know, later on in 12 and 12, not deviating too much here, Bill talked about, in step four, he talked about the problem, self. In order for man to produce our society, this very complex thing that we have here on the face of this earth, we as humans, there are certain instincts that were placed in man. And these basic instincts we all have. They are part of human life. And together, all of these basic instincts put together make up a thing called self. And self is God-given and natural to produce our society. Over on the first column, we have certain instincts called our social instincts. We have companionship, prestige, self-esteem, pride, personal relations. All these things are necessary for us to function as human beings. In the center column, we have a security instinct. It's natural and God-given. And then over in the other column, we have a sex instinct. Bill said, you know, if we didn't care about one another, there would be no society. A socialist thing. If we didn't harvest food or construct shelter, the security instinct, the human race could not survive. If it wasn't for sex, we couldn't reproduce and the human race wouldn't. So these are survival instincts. Survival instincts. Now these same things, all these things together make up self. And they are God-given and necessary. But still yet, as it indicates, you know, on our chart, when one of these things is threatened, then it causes us a problem when it gets out of control. So he says selfish, you know, these things are part of human life. And you know, we have to work to fulfill these things. You know, if you want companionship, you got to work to develop that. And if you want prestige, you have to work at that, and self-esteem and material security. All these things take work. And they are rewards for some task that we accomplish. And as we accomplish the task to receive this reward, we produce our society. You know, but we as people seem like to me, certain people, we alcoholics, we want the reward so much that we overwork to get it, or we shortcut or come dishonest to fulfill. We just want the feeling without doing the work sometimes. And this causes us our problem. This is the root of all human problems.
You know, Bill tells us in the 12 and 12 that these three basic instincts of life are God-given and they're absolutely necessary for survival of the human race. If we cared nothing about each other, if we cared nothing about what other people think of us, the human race would go to complete anarchy, dog-eat-dog situation, and we would fail to survive. If we made no plans to be secure in the future, if we did nothing to provide food, clothing, and shelter, then when the cold weather comes or the drought comes, we're going to starve to death. We know that that's a basic God-given instinct, and we know in AA that we live one day at a time. But we also know that practically everybody in this room's got an insurance policy of some kind to protect us in the future. We know that if it was not for the basic God-given instinct for sex, there would be no reproduction of the human race. And with no reproduction of the human race within a relatively short period of time, the human race would fail to survive. So God has placed in all human beings these three basic instincts. And they're what really creates self. And as long as we use them at the level that God intended for them to be, we're not in conflict with people, places, and things. As long as my desires for companionship and prestige and etc. are where God wants them to be, I'm not in conflict with people. As long as my wants and needs in the security area are where God wants them to be, I'm not continually filled with fears that I'm not going to have enough or I'm going to lose something I've got. As long as my sexual instincts are where God intended for them to be, then I am in the process of reproducing the human race for future generations. But the instant I let any one of the three get beyond what God intended, I'm thrown in conflict with people, places, and things. Now, all of these things, to fulfill them, requires work. If you want to be liked and accepted and respected by people, you have to first decide, well, what is it that society in my area demands that we be in order to be recognized? And then you got to strive to be that way. You got to work at it. You got to do this. You got to do that. You got to do that. And just as important, you may have to quit doing some things that you really like to do if you want to be accepted by people. But there's a reward that comes for that. Bill mentioned it in his story when he said, I had arrived. He had made up his mind what he wanted to be and what it would need to be successful. And sure enough, he drove and he drove and he drove until he got there. And the feeling that you get from having reached those goals is a tremendous, great feeling. But there's only one thing wrong with it. It doesn't last very long. And almost immediately you want to get more, so you start out to get more. It seems to create an insatiable desire for recognition. We set out to be secure, and we decide what it is we need. Maybe one person it's $400. Maybe another person it's $4,000, and maybe another one it's $4 million. And whatever the goal is, we strive to reach it. And when we reach it, God, it feels good to know that we've made it. And the only thing wrong with it is it doesn't last very long. Almost immediately when we reach that goal, we start setting another goal, and it creates an insatiable desire. Now, we know that sex is hard work. You know, there's not any work in the world any harder than sex. Hell, you can put out more energy in 3 minutes if you can last that long than you would all day digging a ditch. When you get through, you just fall over and the sweat's just rolling off. Hard work, but a great reward that you get from it.
The feeling is so great, I just don't know hardly of anything that feels any better. But it doesn't last very long. And almost immediately you want some more of it, and it creates an insatiable desire. And sometimes we want it so bad we start doing it at the wrong time, in the wrong place, with the wrong people. And when we do, it creates conflict with people, places, and things. And then those people we are conflicting with, whether it be in the social, the security, or the sex area, we become a threat to them. And then they in turn retaliate against us and create suffering and pain and humiliation for us. And the book says it's plain that a life run on self-will can hardly be a success, because we're almost always in collision with people, places, and things. And one of the most simple example we can think of, and we've used it for years, is regarding our speed limit today. You know, we know the streets well and says, well, hell, this highway's too good to be driving 55 miles an hour on. Or I just bought this new car, and it's really meant to run 70 and 80, not 55. And we begin to be dissatisfied with 55 miles an hour, and we start speeding up to, say, 65 or 70. And almost immediately, we have to start looking down the road to see where he really is. Is he behind this tree, or is he going to be behind that sign? Is he going to be around that curve? And we start looking in the rearview mirror to see if he's coming up behind us. We've gone from peace of mind to a state of apprehension. And we drive along there for a while at 65 or 70. Well, that isn't good enough either, you know. So we get it up to 80 or 85. Now, we really got to start looking way ahead, looking in the rearview mirror, trying to find two semis with CBs, get in between them because they know where he is. And after a while, sure enough, there he is. And he pulls us over to the side, and he chews us out, and he writes us a ticket, and we end up having to pay a fine for 75, 80, or 100 bucks, and we say, those dirty SOBs, every damn time I leave the house, they're out there waiting on me, all they do is look for me, and so on and so on. And all we did was go from state's will to self-will. It's plain that a life run on self-will can hardly be a success. Under those conditions, we're almost always in collision with people, places, and things. We get to wanting more and more. We start lying. We start cheating. We start conning. We start manipulating. We start working 16, 18, 20 hours a day. We neglect our families and everybody else. And they become unhappy with us, and we become unhappy with them, and we've robbed ourselves of peace of mind. Now, Dr. Silkworth says that whenever we're sober, we're restless, irritable, and discontented. And we added more words, full of shame, fear, guilt, and remorse. And he says if we run around that way long enough, the mind begins to return to the idea of drinking. And we end up taking a drink in order to change the way that we feel. So evidently, if we're going to find a way to live, and live happy, where we won't be restless, irritable, and discontented, it's plain that we're going to have to start doing something about self-will. And my book tells me this is one of the first things that I'm going to have to start working on.
Okay, now we can see that these are part of our natural instincts. And once they are, you know, we can look at companionship, and we look at, and it doesn't disform, it jumps around, and this is why we're going to take an inventory. Once we understand self, then we know that the need for the inventory to really define out the real bottom line of what we got to do. But, you know, if our companionship is threatened, sometimes if our companionship is threatened, you know we're going to have a resentment. Or if our prestige is threatened, our self-esteem, our pride, if it is threatened, if our material and our security instinct, if it is threatened, we're going to have fear. Or if our emotions and if our sex life gets out of control, it's going to throw us into conflict with other people. Self is the root of all human problems. You know, we got many people in trouble today, in prisons. And you know, it's a funny thing about our laws, even man's law, all man's law, that they write a lot of laws. And every one of them is against self-will.
I hate to interrupt, but
we just can't imagine.
It happened at a better time.
Better time. You know, we couldn't have a society, there couldn't be an order, if every person operated on self-will. So this is a root, this is the confusion of our lives. This is the root of our problems. Now let's go.
On your chart, you'll notice that self leads to certain wrongs.
Yeah.
Now this is going to require a little change in the way we define some words.
Yeah.
Most of us, when we pick up the word wrong from step 5, where we admitted to God, ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs, we immediately key in on a list of dirty, filthy, nasty things. Things that we've done to hurt other people. But if you go to the dictionary and look up the word wrong, the dictionary defines a wrong as wrong judging, wrong thinking, or wrong acting. So there's three basic wrongs that come out of self-will. Resentments, fears, and then harms that we do to other people. And what we're going to be looking at are the three basic wrongs that come from self-will and how they in turn create the restless, irritability, discontent, shame, fear, guilt, and remorse.
Okay, let's go to page 62. Now that we have a better understanding of self, we can see that how the book describes it. Selfishness, self-centeredness is what we think is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation, but we invariably saw at some time in the past we had made a decision based on self, which placed us in a position to be hurt. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is the extreme example of a self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think or so. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of selfishness. We must, or it kills us. God makes that possible. And there often seems no way of totally getting rid of self without his aid. Now, self-will is God-given. If self-will is God-given, then only God can correct self-will. You know, there's no way that we can correct self-will if that's our problem. So now we have to make a decision to turn our will and our lives over care to God. We cannot correct this problem. If self-will could correct self-will, we would have already corrected it.
You know, we could see in the study of the first portion of the book the main problem the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. We have a form of insanity when it comes to alcohol. It's evident that the way we think is what causes us to end up drinking. So in step 3, what it's really saying to us is if we want to live and be sober and be happy and have any kind of life, we're going to have to let something else direct our thinking. And we've run always on self-will. But when you're talking about your will, you're really talking about nothing more than your mind. And our mind is nothing but our thinking apparatus. And the way I've thought in the past is what always led me back to the idea of taking a drink. And if I want to live and be free from that, then I'm going to have to start thinking in a different way. So I'm going to make a decision to turn my will, which is my mind or my thinking apparatus, over to the care of God as I understand him. And the step used to say care and direction of God as we understood him. And what I'm really doing is I'm deciding to let him direct my mind. Now I'm also going to turn my will and my life. And my life is nothing more than my action. My life today is the culmination of every action that I've taken throughout my lifetime has got me right here. Now, always my actions have followed my thinking. It's impossible for the body to function without the mind to tell it to do it. Now, we think it does sometimes automatically, but it really doesn't. The mind has got to signal the nervous system in order for the body to take any action at all. And my problem has always been that my mind kept telling my body to do certain things.
And then I would take actions which in turn would throw me in conflict with people, places, and things. And if even I didn't conflict with people, I conflicted with myself, because deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God, and we all seem to know when we're doing okay and when we're not. Now, my dad used to tell me as a kid growing up, he said, "Son, you're always going to be what you think." He said, "Whatever you think, that's what you'll do." And he said, "If you run with a dog, you'll be a dog. And if you run with a good person, you'll be okay." And I didn't know what he was talking about, but today I do. If I want my life to get better, apparently something other than I will have to direct the way I think. And my sponsor had a simple way to get through to me on those things. I told him one time, I said, "I can't do this step three. I'm afraid to let God direct my thinking because I don't know what he would have me be." I said, "Lord, he may want me to go to Africa or China and be a missionary, and I don't want to do that." And he just laughed and he said, "Well, Charlie, at least if God directs your thinking, your mind will not be in the hands of a complete idiot." And said, "It has." He said, "It has up until now." He said, "You've done whatever you wanted to do all your life. And you've run on self-will, and you've made your own decisions, and you stood on your own two feet, and you run your own show." And he said, "The rewards for that kind of living is that you got to become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous." He said, "Just think how great it was." And he finally got through to me that if I'm going to live and be peaceful and happy, where I don't have to drink in order to change the way I feel, something else is going to have to direct my thinking. I think we need to look at the word decision. Decision simply implies further action. I hear people today say, "Oh, I took step three and turned my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him 5 years ago, and my life's still all screwed up and I don't know what's wrong." Well, step three, we don't turn it over to God. We make a decision to turn it over to God. My wife and I have been going to California for 10 years. Every fall, I've decided to go to California. Last year, I took some action, and by golly, we ended up in California. But 9 years before that, all we did was decide, and we never got any results out of it. You know, if you're sitting there now and you're deciding you need to go to the bathroom, if you don't take a little action after a while, you're going to be in serious trouble. So all I'm doing in step three is make a decision. I'll have to take some action to carry that out.
Yeah, we go into the words, as Charlie said, decision. A decision precedes all action. And a decision is no good unless it's acted on. It means to choose a course of action. And if you're, we have said, if you're an alcoholic, if you're honest, you've got two courses of action. Continue as you are, that's one road. Or take the other road, insanity or death, a life on a spiritual basis. And then now after we get those two steps, then it says choose a course of action. And it says we stand at the turning point. I love the word. He actually paints these pictures. We're standing at the crossroads. And if you're an alcoholic, there are two roads, and we says make a decision. And we're choosing a course of action. And if we make this choice, then we have to give up something, and it causes a price, and it talks about self-will. And it says, neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. This is the how and the why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. And I love these expressions Bill uses. He says, you know, all this time, that we have been living, God was directing this world. God always has directed, and he always will. And all this time that I was messed up in my life, I was just playing God. I wasn't God, I was just playing God. It didn't work, except we decided that here after the drama of life, God was going to be our director. Now already he's gotten director back in. They got it out of the other part, but they didn't get it out of this part of the book. He is a principal, we are his agents. He is a father, we are his children. Now he says here, most good ideas are simple, but this concept was the keystone of the new triumph through which we passed to freedom. step three, he's using, Charlie's put up another diagram, but Bill right here in the book is painting another. He just keeps painting these pictures for us. He says step three is the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we pass to freedom. Now, you know, we notice that when they built these stone gates in those days, the stones were stacked. And the diverged stone in the top of the gate was the keystone. All these other stones, they didn't have a lot of stuff to hold them together, and they had to be cut. And they would lean against this keystone in the top, and it was a pressure point. And the keystone, as they pressed against the keystone, it would support the whole gate. So he says step three is the keystone of this arch through which we're going to pass to freedom. He talks about how vital step three is and what role it plays in the gate to freedom. On the chart that Charlie put up, he put up the first two steps, and we see the problem, we see the solution, and then we come to the step three, which is the dividing point, and we got two courses, to continue drinking or to believe and accept spiritual help. One road leads to insanity and death. The other road leads to sanity and sobriety.
And not always do we make the right decision.
That's right.
You know, we could recognize that we're powerless over alcohol and our life's unmanageable. And we could recognize there's a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. But we could make the decision, well, we don't want that power to do that because we want to continue to drink. And many of us do that. Or we could recognize we're powerless over alcohol and there's a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. And we could still make a decision that we don't want that power to do that because we're going to do it our way. And many of us do that. I did that for a long time and damn near died from the disease. But if I heard enough, and if I have the ability to surrender, then maybe I can take step one and recognize I'm powerless over alcohol, my life's unmanageable. And then maybe I can take two and come to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. And then I can make a decision to let that power do that. And this is the road chart to decision as we follow this through. And the decision can go many different ways. I think we need to recognize that. And if we decide to let God do it, then what we really are deciding is to let Him be the director of our life. Bill referred to this, simple but not easy. A price had to be paid. It meant the destruction of self-centeredness. And once before, he's talked about the spiritual structure. You know, belief was the cornerstone, and now we lay the keystone, and now we see what the structure is going to be. It's going to be a new and triumphant arch, and we're going to pass through that arch to freedom. And it starts with the removal of self-will. Remember last night, we said that you really don't have to get anything. You got to get rid of. And if self can begin to disappear, then God's will can begin to enter. But any mind that is filled with self-will cannot function on God's will. There's only two ways we can go, self-will or God's will. At any one given time, we're on one of the two always. And my trouble has always been that I've been on Charlie's will rather than God's will, and that threw me always in conflict.
Okay, when we sincerely took such a position, this change of position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer being all-powerful. He provided what we needed if we kept close to him but performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt a new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, we discovered we could face life successfully. As we became conscious of His presence and began to lose our fears of today, tomorrow, the hereafter, we were reborn. We were now at step three. And this is, you know, how many of them took this step. Did they give us an example? Many of us said to our Maker, as we understood Him, God, I offer myself to Thee to bear with me and do as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. We thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to him. We found it be very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person, such as our wife, best friend, our spiritual advisor. And this is sometimes, we talked in the early days in the first 100, they had a ritual to do this, and they went kind of through a little thing in the old groups. And when you took step three, you would always sometimes take it with another member. And I think they talked about down in Dr. Bob's house, they would take them upstairs, and two or three would go with you. And after you get it all, get down on your knees, and y'all take step three, and then they would vote and see if you took it good enough. And then, you know, I mean, this is kind of reference to the way they were doing it. But it's better to meet God alone than one might misunderstand. The wording, of course, was quite optional, as long as we expressed the idea of voicing it without reservation. Now, step three, and you know, here's the subtle results of step three. And I don't know if we have gotten sometimes step three out of perspective, like it's a final thing, or like it's where, as Charlie said, we just made a decision. We didn't turn our will and our life for care of God. But for some reason, we think that step three is the ultimate thing. And here he says, this was only a beginning. Step three is just a beginning. Though if honesty had humbly made an effect, sometimes a great one, and I mean in the case of a sudden spiritual experience, a great effect was felt at once. But in most cases, step three is only a beginning. And so it doesn't give us, we don't get a lot of results of taking step three. Step three is just a decision. And that we'll find out as we study the steps and as we go through the recovery process, we're going to have more results after the action steps than step three. Step three is just a decision to turn our will and our lives over the care of God. The only way we can turn our will and our lives over the care of God is 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. We cannot turn we make a decision to do it in step three. And then we have to take the actions to carry out the decision, which are the action steps. And we get more results after the action steps than we do from just taking step three.
You know, you always get some relief from making a decision.
That's right.
How many times in our life have we had a decision to make? We got a problem, and we wrestle with it, and we wrestle with it, and we wrestle with it, and we procrastinate, and we put it off, and then finally we make a decision.
Yeah.
And you always feel some relief, right or wrong. You get some relief when you make a decision. So we're going to feel better when we make this decision. But the decision is just like what happened to Columbus. Columbus was still standing on the side of the ocean when he made the decision. And it was only when he took action to carry it out that he got results. And our book is going to show us the same pattern. It says, next we launched out on a course of vigorous action. The first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us had never attempted. Though our decision, step three, was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and to be rid of the things within ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. Now, if we are to let God direct our thinking, then it's going to be necessary for us to see what is in our mind that has always blocked us off from God's thinking. In order for Him to direct it, we're going to have to see what blocks it off and then get rid of the blockage so He can direct our thinking. Just like Columbus had to do. Columbus had to decide, what is it I need to do in order to be able to prove that the world is round? And he had to take action. And we'll have to also. God's will has always been blocked off from my mind because of what Charlie wants to do. Self-will.